We get things rolling this afternoon, though, with the author of a wonderful book, actually more than one. He's the author of the fantastic Fantasyland, a columnist for Wall Street Journal, and his brand new book is an unbelievably fun read, The Captain Class. Sam Walker, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Rich. Thank you so much for having me.
Like so many things that are wonderful in life, the genesis of this book was actually jealousy. Is that right?
That's right. I go back all the way to when I was 11, and I played on a youth baseball team when I was a kid, and it was always the same kids, the same neighborhood. You know, we were always okay. We won about half of our games, and, you know, we were more concerned about going to Dairy Queen after the game than really than winning or losing. But one summer when I was 11, I don't know what happened, but suddenly we just couldn't lose. And all these kids who used to let balls roll under their legs, you know, and drop fly balls, suddenly started making plays, and the pitchers did their job, and we went 12-0 that season and never accomplished it again. And, you know, I thought at the time, okay, well, this is normal. You know, I'll be part of a great team, you know, many times over. But, you know, as my athletic career fizzled, you know, after high school, as most of ours do, I realized I never had that chance. And even, you know, in recreational sports, I'd never really been on another great team. So I was obsessed with this idea. I just remembered that summer, and I always sort of yearned to be part of a great team. And that's when I bumped into the 2004 Red Sox.
Well, and then began the process. Before you could figure out what creates the world's greatest teams, you had to establish what those teams were. And that process of culling hundreds and hundreds of great teams into what you call tier one, the greatest of all time, that's an impressive feat of organization and research right there.
It was all consuming. When I first started doing this, I had seen the Red Sox win the World Series in 2004, and I thought, okay, I want to find out what makes great teams make that turn. And so, yeah, no, I started thinking, all right, I'm going to write a column for the Wall Street Journal about this. I set aside a couple of weeks and thought, all right, I'm going to try to identify the best teams in sports history, and then I'll see what they had in common. And I laugh at that now because it was 2005, and 11 years later, here I am. It took just a monstrous amount of work. I realized I had to look at every team from every major sport in the entire world throughout history. So we're talking about thousands and thousands of teams. And, you know, just getting a hold of the records was kind of a feat. And then I had to set some criteria for what I considered greatness to be. And I realized it was a lot harder than it seemed. So finally I came up with 8 tests or criteria that a team had to meet. And I whittled it down to about 122 finalists. And then of that group, I wound up with the 16 teams that are unambiguously outstanding. I think I call them freaks. These are freak teams that achieved something over a period of time that no other team in their sport had ever matched.
And one of the things that I enjoyed most about the book was learning about these teams and frankly, some of these sports that I knew very little about, including the Collingwood Magpies of Australian rules football. All I knew of Australian rules football is what I saw in the early days of ESPN when that was a regular feature.
Yeah, it's a crazy sport to watch. It's really kind of funny and brutal and entertaining, even though you don't really know what's going on necessarily. But yeah, no, I figured, you know, to find these teams that were really freaks, like had done something totally unique, I had to dig deep. Now, there were a lot of teams you might recognize, like the Boston Celtics of the late 50s and 60s, the Montreal Canadiens, Pittsburgh Steelers. There was a Yankees team in there. So some of them were familiar, but, you know, there were a lot of soccer teams Americans might not necessarily have heard of. And some other sort of fringe sports like handball, which is a huge sport in Europe with hundreds of millions of fans, but, you know, Americans don't even know what it is most of the time.
Now, before you could determine what makes a great team, you first had to rule out what it wasn't and what factors were not part of that. And some of the things that we would commonly think of, great organization, having the best players, and even great coaches, were not the biggest factors.
Yeah, I came into this with no idea what I was going to find, and I had my own prejudices. I thought probably a combination of talent and coaching, maybe money, maybe tactics. But what I discovered was that none of those things were consistent among all these teams. Some of them had great coaches, some didn't. Some had a lot of talent, some had very low levels of talent. The only thing in the end that they all shared in common was that their winning streaks corresponded almost perfectly to the arrival and departure of one player on a team. And it was inevitably, in every case, the captain or the future captain of the team. So suddenly, this book about great teams turned into a book about leadership. But the consistency, the pattern could not have been more clear.
We're talking with Sam Walker. His book is entitled The Captain Class. And those guys, the glue guys, those captains, also didn't fit the profile of what we would perhaps expect in becoming crucial players. First of all, they were almost never the best player on the team, and they didn't even possess some of what we would normally think of as leadership skills.
True. You know, it really surprised me. I mean, I think if you built a captain in a laboratory, you would say, okay, I'm going to take a superstar with incredible celebrity charisma, you know, who could motivate the team with a big speech, you know, someone who would take the big shot with a game on the line, someone who's a great model of sportsmanship, who never caused conflict inside the team. And the exact opposite was true. I mean, it was amazing. There were a few star players in there, but most of them were support players, role players. They were not great talents, not celebrities. Some of them you'd never heard of. I mean, my favorite example is the U.S. women's soccer team from 1999. Everyone thinks Mia Hamm, you know, Brandi Chastain, Julie Foudy. But it was Carla Overbeck who was the captain, and she just was someone who didn't want any attention and was happy not to be in the spotlight. But the other thing about them that was so fascinating is that they created conflict inside their teams. They would go to the mattresses over anything they thought was impeding the team's ability to win. And, you know, the other thing that was fascinating, and Tom Brady comes to mind in this regard, is that, you know, they would break the rules. They would push the rules to the absolute limit on the field. I mean, they would do anything it took if they thought they could get away with it in order to win. Now, off the field, though, they were completely different. I mean, they were homebodies, never got into any trouble, didn't like the limelight, and, you know, were almost introverts in many cases. And I thought that was really interesting. They also didn't give speeches, which just shocked to me. None of them. You think of motivating your team, you give a big speech, fire them up in the locker room. But all of them didn't like doing that. Some of them purposely avoided it. They really prefer to talk to teammates individually and to circulate widely and talk about practical matters, you know, the task at hand. And I thought that communication style was not at all what I expected.
Yeah, one of the great chapters that I enjoyed was the power of nonverbal displays. And it opens with the story of the great Jack Lambert, who didn't have to say anything to lead.
He was really amazing. I mean, there were some. He was talkative within the team. You know, he would. The Steelers used to have these sessions in the sauna where they would sit after the game and give each other brutal critiques of their play, and that was Lambert's haven. And he talked a lot to his teammates, but you know, he wasn't a talkative person. And instead, you know, like a lot of these captains, he had this other means of communication, which was amazing. In this particular game that I wrote about, it was a game against Cincinnati. They'd started the season 1-4. People had written them off, thought they were dead. He played this brilliant game, you know, spotting the team 10 points on defense. And but during the game, he had a cut on his hand, a really deep cut, which was bandaged up. The bandages came off. Blood spurted all over his uniform and his pants. It sure was a mess. And, you know, I asked one of the trainers on that team why they didn't just fix the bandages or, you know, change his uniform. And they just kind of laughed and said, no way. We never would have approached him. I mean, we never thought he would never have wanted us to do that. He loved having blood on his uniform. He was a motivator and an intimidator, and he knew the message that it would send to his teammates. And, you know, all of these captains did things like that that just were astonishing and, you know, I think had a really deep and profound effect on their teammates.
When you talk about giving their all for the team, I don't know that any story in the book can rival that of Buck Shelford the New Zealand All Blacks. What a story that was.
Yeah, I can't even do it justice. People don't believe me when I tell them this story, but is there a family version I can tell on the radio?
You can tell it all on the air. Okay, We're fine. Yeah.
All right, good. This was a famous, famous match in France. And, you know, you have to know much about rugby to understand this, but the All Blacks of New Zealand are just this amazing sports dynasty. And at the time, they were kind of down, though. They hadn't won much. And this was Shelford's second game with the team, and they played France and had beaten the crap out of France, you know, a week earlier, and the French were mad, and they came out, and their whole thing was they were going to just beat up the Kiwis, and so Shelford was their primary target because he played really well in the first game. So I think I'll get the order right here. So first he got kicked in the face, lost three teeth. Then he got someone punched him in the face and tried to get him, bait him into a fight. And then he got knocked unconscious, completely out, and you know, came back. He kept coming back and kept playing. Finally, one of the French players kicked him in the balls. And he just sort of shrugged it off, you know, dipped a little water down there and kept playing. Was finally knocked out of the game after sustaining a concussion and just didn't even know where he was. So after the game, in the locker room, he was getting undressed, and he got undressed. And I won't get into the details, but his teammates were horrified because he had his scrotum ripped open. And things were out of there that should have been in there. I don't want to say any more than that, but he had played through that injury. I mean, which was just incredible. And that to me was actually confusing. I mean, all these captains had this incredible relentlessness, ability to play through pain that you wouldn't imagine. But that case was extreme. And really, when I heard about that, I thought, these people are crazy. I mean, this isn't normal. And they lost the game anyway. I mean, well, it wasn't even tactical. But it sort of showed me that these people had this level of commitment in putting the team first that really went beyond anything, including their own physical well-being.
Perhaps the captain best known to fans here in New England, Bill Russell, of those legendary Celtics teams, and a guy who, you know, among other things, didn't score because he didn't need to. It wasn't important to him that he felt he could help the team best through his defensive work.
That's one of the great hallmarks. So there are seven traits that these captains shared in common, and I've talked about some of them, but one of them is what I call carrying water. And the fascinating thing about Russell was, you know, he wasn't a great shooter, and he wasn't a good ball handler. And that he played at a time when, you know, the center was supposed to be the engine of the offense, and he wasn't. I mean, he scored maybe, I think, his 15 points a game average, but his real skill was rebounding and blocking shots. And blocking shots was something no one else was doing. He kind of invented that whole genre of defense. And, you know, but the thing about Russell was he cared more about how he played without the ball than how he played with it. And he did all the grunt work for the team and did not mind being in the shadows. In fact, another trait they all had was that they hated individual accolades. And, you know, Russell was famous for this. I mean, he turned down the Hall of Fame. You know, he said he wouldn't go to his own Hall of Fame induction. And he later said because he thought that the Hall of Fame honored individuals and he wanted to be remembered for team play. You know, over and over again, he didn't care at all about the individual awards or his own statistics. All he cared about was that they won championships. And they won 11 in 13 years, including 8 in a row, which is unparalleled and, frankly, way better than the Chicago Bulls, which everyone points to as a great dynasty. But it was that selfless nature and that relentlessness that he showed that pushed that team forward. He's the only thing about that team that was there for the whole streak. It was his career. Red Auerbach, you know, left in the middle of it, and even their owner passed away. I mean, nothing was consistent over that streak except him.
At the end of the book, you talk about the decline of leadership and the fact that a number of teams have even gotten away from the idea of captains, and that part of this is because of the nature of big-time sports these days that emphasize not matchup of teams, but matchups of individual and those celebrity players.
Right. You know, it's a lot of it, I think, is economics. I think the sports business has just gotten so wealthy through, you know, TV deals, mainly in the last couple of decades, that what they do with the money is they want to go after bankable stars. I mean, they want to put on a good show. That's almost more important than winning at this point. And, you know, so what do? You get star players who sell tickets. You get a celebrity coach. So in a lot of teams, you see this dynamic where there's a star player and a coach, and essentially it's a battle between them for control of the team. And, you know, what these captains were, because they weren't the best players, they were these middle managers. They were these intermediaries between the management and the other players. And they had the independence to decide what they were going to do with the team based on what they thought was right. And you know, that's the middle management in general, not just in sports, but in business, is sort of on the outs. A lot of people are going to flatter management structures. And I think that's a huge mistake because, you know, it's the fact that these captains were able to use their own independent mindedness and to dissent when they thought it was appropriate and to listen to the players sometimes, listen to management sometimes. It gave these teams another element, another kind of a second coach who was able to help the team forward. And that's really missing. I was shocked at how many teams don't have captains. And, you know, the Celtics are a famous example. They don't have a captain. And that it's interesting, you know, watching the dynamics on the team. But even in the NHL, at the beginning of the seasons, there were seven teams that hadn't named a captain. And even though the league rules say they have to. And, you know, it's really stunning to me that we've kind of lost the thread here, because I think that leadership role seems to be crucial.
Now, the debate goes on about sport, whether it builds character or reveals it. But as I look at the seven traits of elite captains that you've outlined in the book, can those traits translate beyond the sports world into leadership and life?
I think so. I mean, look, my book's about sports, and I'll have to let people judge for themselves. But, you know, there's a lot of research that I mentioned in the book that's been done on workplace teams. And, you know, the dynamics are often very similar, especially in teams that are performance teams, like an airplane cockpit crew or an emergency room unit that perform under pressure and don't get do-overs. You know, I think those kinds of teams definitely match the criteria. But, you know, I think all teams at some level, teams are teams, you know, and I think that the seven traits that I've outlined, the interesting thing about them is that skill, talent, charisma don't matter. I mean, it didn't matter. And I think that what we can take away from it, no matter what business we're in, is that that great leadership is behavior. I mean, these are behaviors and choices that people make on the field and behind the scenes. And I think that we can all monitor our behavior and become better leaders.
The book is entitled The Captain Class, The Hidden Force That Creates the World's Greatest Teams. Impressive research, well worth it, Sam. It is just a fantastic read, funny, and one you can't put down. I read it in one night because I couldn't stop.
Great.
It was
Thank
so good. We appreciate you being with us this afternoon, Sam.
Okay, thanks.
Sam Walker, The Captain Class, here on Downtown.